don't just get destroyed. Or, I mean, there are real desires and needs behind that. And I think we, you know, you read the newspaper and you just read this, like, hysteria, these things going on, this, like, ridiculous sort of... who was talking about Dr. Strangelove the other night? Oh, we were talking about it last night at dinner. You know, you very seldom see films like that, that really portray, you know, men in power as, you know, as victims of their desires, and we in turn as victims of their desires.
Yeah.
You know?
So. Yeah, one of the most recent examples is poor Yuri Andropov, or whatever his name is, the man who's seen as the likely successor to Brezhnev.
Aha.
Being his big honor of the moment is being appointed chairman of the funeral committee. And so
that's it.
So,
yeah,
he was shown a lot, and I did not bother to watch film clippings about the parade on Sunday in Moscow, but now people are noticing that he was on camera a lot. And
when did Brezhnev, I didn't know about it till last night. I bought the Tribune yesterday. It wasn't in the newspaper.
No, because it was announced, I think he died on Wednesday, and it was announced yesterday.
I see.
Officially, there were rumors, but they've been going on for so long.
Did he have cancer? Where did he die?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if that will ever come out. Uh-huh. He had been ill for several years, but on Sunday he was reviewing a parade in Red Square. That's where all the portraits were hanging out there. Now this man has... They expect that it's already been decided, but that it will take a while before it's really announced. But the man who's seen as his probable successor is chairman of the funeral committee, which is... it's like, yeah, he's the designer that they've hired to choreograph the funeral, because everything that happens there is, of course, really important. Who stands where?
Yeah.
Who's filmed when? I've always found that a really intriguing aspect of Soviet and Chinese politics, kind of all of the speculation and guesswork and all of the other things that you have to know about those two places, which I don't, but which other people profess to know, in terms of figuring out what's going on in the continual power shuffle.
Yeah, boy, I've read really something incredible. Oh, now there's just such... I mean, what's happening in China, I mean, it doesn't make me feel too good, honestly. I mean, I just think it's certainly not what it used to be. But I read in the paper yesterday that there is a mass campaign of female infanticide going on in China now. You know, and I don't know how prevalent that was 10 years ago. I have a feeling that it might not have been. Of course, it was. I'm sure it went on, but I have a feeling not so much as now. And they're worried now that there won't be enough women, you know, because they're killing so many girl babies.
Yeah,
it's extraordinary.
Yeah, it's not a few. It's not a few thousand. It's tens of thousands.
Boy,
of baby girls who are being killed, and babies who are being killed in revenge.
And the point is that, like, how can, you know, again, like, how do we talk about government policy? I said this last night, you know, in terms of, the night here, I don't think I used the word patriarchy, but last night I used it once on the panel before I signed off. I just had nothing else to say. I said, how do you talk about politics? And how do we talk about, it's like, one guy said, well, we're all talking English, and, like, you know, talking about American art and American, and I just said, I refuse to be an apologist for American cultural imperialism. I'm not here as a guardian of American culture, but we're speaking English, and, like, I wanted to say, I didn't say it, listen, schmuck, you think I feel that much different here in Holland than I do in America? You think that I decide diplomacy? You think that I, you know, sell paintings, you know? I mean, what is my position vis-a-vis my gender in this society? And again, it's like, look what's happening in China. You know, we talk about leftists. Did I get involved in leftists, you know, Paul? I mean, what? I mean, I'm peripheral to that.
Yeah.
You know, as girl children, we were, you know, it's just...
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's... I didn't even bring up the subject when we first started talking today in terms of all the anti-American feelings that are pretty strong.
And I absolutely understand and support them to certain degrees.
Right, but when you're just seen as sort of the puppet representative of all of that, it's kind of wearing. Most of the time, I don't think about it.
Well, especially when a man is accusing me of it, I just want to puke in his face.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, you just have to know a few things about what the Dutch government is involved in, too, and toss it out, and they don't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
But especially with all the big bicentennial flutter in 1982, which...
Here? What?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Maybe you didn't even hear about it.
No.
I think it's great. None of my American friends knew anything about the bicentennial, but it was 200 years of unbroken diplomatic relations between the Netherlands and the United States. And that's why Queen Beatrix and Prince Klaus, poor man, went to the United States twice, and all kinds of tours and exchanges were organized. Queen Beatrix invited 1,000 American businessmen who a few weeks ago were taken on tours of the Rijksmuseum, Dutch masters, and special publications were arranged, and a couple of Dutch orchestras have turned the states. And in terms of the Holland Festival, it's a cultural event which takes place. So maybe you've been here at some point in time.
No.
Well, Laurie Anderson came over.
Uh-huh. Very formal event.
Yeah. Anyway, there was a lot of discussion of mostly useless information that was being tossed around about what had been going on for the past 200 years, but some interesting examination of the roots of anti-Americanism here, having to recognize that it exists.
Mm.
One Dutch professor wrote this article, which I really liked, talking about really the crucial period of discovery and exploration, and also daring to mention the fact that the Dutch were the worst, the most notorious slave traders, and they were the most feared. And owning up to some of that responsibility way back then.
Mm.
But he
said also the Dutch presence in South Africa, compared to the English presence there, the Afrikaan.
Yeah.
It's pretty extraordinary,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, the whole Dutch performance in Indonesia has yet to be exposed worldwide. It's pretty well known, but it's not.
Mm.
It wasn't really as publicized as it maybe should have been.
Mm-hmm.
But he said at one point that the New World was sort of stumbled across as an obstacle. And as much as people found certain things that they liked and developed there, that image has remained.
Mm-hmm.
It's still the metaphor of just a being in the way.
Right, that's right. Yeah.
And all of these, a lot of the reaction to everything American is also, in Holland anyway, where it's a very principled people who work on the validity of beliefs and lines of thought, that the United States has just not lived up to what it was supposed to be. So, fully.
Well, I think that we all think that to some degree, unless you think that the United States has in fact lived up to what it was supposed to be, which is even more frightening.
Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
In terms of like, what are the results of a heavily developed capital economy? You know, what does work, you know? So, I'm not talking about democracy, I'm talking about economics.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the same thing, and yet one can really obliterate the other in a way. And I think we're seeing that in America.
Mm-hmm. There are a couple of other phrases of yours to me tonight, and you can tell me before I quote them out of context whether you find that interesting to do or not.
Mm-hmm.
a couple of things that you said. And at one point in response to maybe Lawrence, I can't remember who it was, you said, the question is, what should we be digesting? In terms of, sorry, messages. How does that?
You said the word digest.
You're choking already.
Right.
Yeah.
Maybe you should take some water.
No, it's okay.
Digest.
What should we be digesting? Yeah. I didn't pick up on.
I think what Lawrence was bringing out is he didn't.
I want to know what you just.
Yeah. Well, I think that he didn't say the word, but he was talking about. He suggested something, and I said, "Do you mean?" And the reason I said is because it's a work that I'm doing, so I just mm-hmm. knew the words. I said, "You mean I will become what I mean to you?"
Yeah.
And he said, "Right, right." And I said, "I don't necessarily think that because I think this can be a problem, but because you use certain strategies of parody, that you have to be subsumed by that original thing that you're miming or mimicking in a way, which is why my work has words in it." You know, I was making a difference between the photo work in the art world now that's ironic or something, and I don't think it goes far enough. I think that it remains too implicit that it is, that it does become its original in a way, and why I use words in a way. So I told him that I didn't necessarily feel that because you were working in a parodic mode that you had to become that mode, you know. And that was so that you don't have to digest something as, you know, what it's supposed to be aping in a way, that it becomes something else. It becomes a consideration of that original. I think that's what I was saying to him. But as far as digesting, I mean,
I guess the point is that it's suddenly placed an emphasis on the content of a work. Something which one can see in passing, rather than the style and the whole build-up to its production
mm-hmm.
and how we perceive it. It really had a lot more to do with actually visually what is there, what is being said.
Mm.
That's what I picked up on.
Mm.
Does that say anything to you?
I don't know. I mean, I think that like all works generate sort of different meanings, many meanings. And that's what I mean when I say I don't think that there should be a correct reading on my work, which is what political, you know, like at the Whitney again, they said, well, I really like your work, but aren't you saying that? Aren't you speaking of a closure of art? Isn't that what you, I thought, that's why I liked your work. Isn't that mm-hmm. what you're, you know, that sort of thing. And it's not that I'm thriving on a kind of ambiguity. But I'm also not interested in a kind of closure. I'm not interested in doing like dogmatic sort of, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to, you know, necessarily entertain that kind of thought.
Is there any particular subject matter which attracts you more than others in terms of your own approach to other people's work, leaving your own work aside?
There's not that much work in the art world that interests me. To start with. It's something I said last night, that basically I can talk about almost all painting and almost all sculpture on the level that I think that artists or, you know, people write, people make films, whatever, they set certain problems for themselves to solve. They build certain scenarios, certain field of like elements that they're going to solve, and they construct an equation. And the most elegant equations, the ones resolved most perfectly, most masterfully, are in fact successful works, you know. And I can say, that's very masterful, this is a good artist. I can really admire that, but it doesn't mean that it interests me. And that's something that I brought up last night in terms of certain painters or, you know. Laurie Anderson is a good example of someone I consider to be a very good artist. But there are certain elements in her work that don't interest me at all. Yeah. again, Sandro Chia, Francesco Clemente, very good artists. But I mean, I'm not concerned with that at all.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I basically, the work which I think is most strong and powerful aesthetically is film work sometimes. And there isn't much of that. I mean, I think when Fassbinder died, we lost one of our finest artists.
Mm-hmm.
And what can I say? I mean, when this guy last night wants to talk about Marcus Lubbers, you know, fuck, man, I would fucking mm-hmm. rather see Lola than look at that shitty painter. So, and I look at those two aesthetic practices on a similar level. I mean, like, they're celebrated on
yeah.
similar levels. I mean, I don't see how you can, I can see the address is different. I understand a gallery address because I engage in it, you know. But, you know, I am not going to sit and reify Marcus Lubbers' work, you know.
Well, it's interesting to consider your approach, which has something to do with the kind of border area between not really focusing very much on the starting moment, but focusing on that period in between, but and still delivering the final product. There's a lot of emphasis here still on the process rather than the product.
Mm.
And
that,
the apple itself is focused on things which don't ever actually start or finish. They do,
mm-hmm.
but and they have to for bureaucratic reasons.
That's
from here. But it has something to do with other considerations of time or space or something
mm-hmm.
like that. And I think it's interesting to look at your work alongside of projects which are seemingly very different, but it's actually a different scale
mm-hmm.
of the same message. In
yeah. I mean, that's what Hal said when he was writing about Jenny and I, and to some degree this is true, and that in many ways we were less making art objects than playing with signs in a way. Although both our works have been, you know, solidified within gallery constructs. It's also less, like I say, like I'm really not that interested in a contemplative element in my work so much. And I think that in both our works, that comes later. That consideration is something you carry on in your head with you. I think that was a good point that he made.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And that, I indulge in the gallery structure because it allows me to, like, to just... Because I understand that, like, for me to be outside it and invisible would be an archetype in terms of being a woman, you know, in a way. Because women are so disallowed that. And frequently, like, people say, well, like, what about, like, more women painting? Or how come we can't show at this gallery? And, like, I don't support that work, you know. I support any production that a woman does because I understand how much more difficult it has been for us to define ourselves through our production. I really think that's true. I know a lot of men struggle too, but it's just that, like, right before I left, a man that I'm very close to said to me, he had just had a disappointment with the film, and he said, didn't you felt like this, you felt like this, you know how I feel now. And I said, yeah, except I haven't spent all those years, like, saying I've got to be famous by the time I'm 23 the way you have. You know, that wasn't the way I was socialized. To me, I was just as comfortable. To me, anonymity and fame are very similar.
Mm-hmm.
Because they both grant you not that I've experienced fame, you know.
Yeah.
And not at all, I'm not saying that. But you, they're similar because they allow you dispensations. They allow you yourself in a way,
mm-hmm.
you know. I mean, it's the middle part which is involved with struggle and desire and need and, you know.
Yeah.
Which is the part that's painful. But he has been experiencing that so much more because when you were, the way he was a boy child, well, you know, when you're 34, forget it. You have to be, you know, you have to be Steven Spielberg. When you're 28, you have to do this. You have to
yeah.
do this when you're 30. You have to do this when you're 50. And as a woman, it was just different.
Mm-hmm.
But, so anyway, that has to do with, like, asserting yourself within a gallery context also, and not being invisible all the time.
funny experience when this book was released. I took it around to places here. And I kind of I played up certain elements and played down others, but basically male-female considerations were I gave a sort of paid token respect to certain things, but it was not the overriding
mm-hmm.
consideration
mm-hmm.
of the book. The back cover is a joke on the old Freudian question of what do women
mm-hmm.
want and,
mm-hmm.
and things like that. But anyway, I basically worked a hell of a lot to be able to publish it and did the layout for the first and last time, probably I'll ever do a layout, really. Yeah. And struggled up and down to the third floor, walk up with all these books and things. So you're finally strolling in casually to bookstores with this product, and went into the women's bookstore here, or one of them. At that point it was the one. And this woman refused to take it to give to the collective because it wasn't about women as such. You know, her view was so hard line that she couldn't see anything
mm.
about. Of course, they were selling Mrs. Dalloway and
right.
all kinds of other big names that
yeah.
were for them. But
I had that experience years ago with heresies, years ago.
Right.
You know, that it wasn't just about women and women. But, I mean, it's complex. I there was a conference at Barnard early in the year on sexuality that I took part in with another, I did a workshop with a woman who's a film theorist. She's very, very smart, Marianne Dome. And at the main meeting, it was like there were these sort of picketing and disruptions by the Women Against Porno. And although I understand what they're saying to some degree, I think it's just, I mean, that's not where I put my, you know, I think that there's a kind of, I mean, women's issues and positions are as pluralist as any other. There's no
sure.
way that we could feel, you know, exactly
yeah.
the same.
Yeah, sure. Well, I've had enough confrontation.
But that's extreme. I would say for them not to take your book, I would say it would be extreme.
Well, this was one person from a collective, and I think she was having a bad day, but
mm.
still her reaction was quite vehement
mm.
and sarcastic
yeah.
about defending the cause. But, you know,
is she a separatist?
Not seeing it all. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's
mm.
that whole line. But I also don't want to work within that particular framework. As if you're a blonde-haired, blue-eyed American,
mm.
you don't stand a chance in a lot of situations. So whether it's male or female,
mm, mm.
there's
but
too,
stand
too
a
many
chance,
associations.
But there's so many
right
blonde, blue-eyed people here.
Yeah, right, right. But I was basically foreign. I mean, I departed when I was about 19. I've spent more time out of the States than in the States
yeah.
in the past decade. But still, it takes a while to leave all of that behind.
Sure, sure.
Yeah,
yeah.
yeah. Last question, was there anything that came from the audience that was really interesting to you on Wednesday evening? You can say no if you want to.
I think there might have been some things. I mean, some things just went right, but I just thought there was no, like the two people upstairs, you know, I don't know who the man was or whatever. I just felt like, and the woman, too. I just felt that there was no real thought going into it. People were just saying, well, I don't really believe this, but I'll say that great quote that Breck said, feel is something I do with my hands. You know?
Yeah.
That there was no thought at all. It was just what I'm feeling more in terms of the woman. Which is, I think, a sort of stereotype that women really have to be careful of. You know, it's true that we do see things on a certain level that men might not because of our disallowance from dominance. But I also think that we might be surprised to consider how much we feel is in fact a dictation to us on how we should feel.
Yeah.
So, you know. So I just couldn't respond to a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
But you get that anywhere. I don't think it has to be. this particular alliance. No, I was pleased. I was pleased. Exhausted.
Oh, that woman was Nan Hoover.
Barbara told me afterwards. I don't know her work.